welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppins.
My name is Kathleen McGowan.
And as we approach Halloween of 2012,
we are going to shift gears a little bit from our normal Spirit Revolution topics and go into the world of the truly creepy and haunted.
The world of something which we found out about only 2 weeks ago. We didn't even know it existed. Scary children. Now you might think that scary children, everybody is familiar with them. Just like scary animals, they run around quickly around a house. They disappear, they jump on things. They break things, sometimes in the dead of night. Those, however, are just people, normal children. They do these things because they are children. What we are talking about is slightly different children.
We're very excited to have on our show tonight author David Weatherly, who has written a fascinating book called The Black-Eyed Children. And The Black-Eyed Children is the topic of our show tonight. Before I welcome David, I want to say that I had never heard of this phenomena of the Black-Eyed Children until just a couple of weeks ago when we were at the Paradigm Symposium in Minneapolis.
And just to point out, black-eyed children doesn't mean they were hit by somebody. That is not the kind of black eye we're talking about. We're talking about the fact that the pupils are black.
So I'd like to welcome David Weatherly to our show tonight. David, welcome to the Spirit Revolution.
Good evening. Thanks for having me on.
I was absolutely transfixed by your talk at the Paradigm Symposium. I think I made Philip a little bit nervous because I was completely obsessed with this subject after listening to you because I'd never heard of it before, and I was completely fascinated by it. And it's creepy, it's fascinating, it's scary, and like I said, I was completely transfixed by it. So, because I think that most of our listeners have never heard of this idea of children with solid black eyes appearing out of nowhere, can you just start from the beginning? Tell us a little bit about what a black-eyed child is and how this phenomena got started.
Sure. It is a pretty compelling topic. The modern version of this phenomenon really came into prominence in the late 90s during the early days of the internet. What happened was there was a gentleman who posted a story on an early discussion board. His name was Brian Bethel. He's a journalist out of Texas. And Bethel posted a story about an encounter that he had with two children in a parking lot. And the short version of Bethel's story is that he went to pay a bill at a Dropbox late one night. He went to the strip mall. He was sitting in his car writing the check when two kids approached his car. They tapped on the window. And it wasn't really a bad neighborhood, but he was a little bit uneasy just for some reason that he couldn't quite put his finger on. So he only put the window down a tiny bit. And these kids started to say things to him like, "Hey, mister, can you give us a ride to our house? We want to see a movie. We forgot our money." You know, they're throwing these comments at him. And Bethel had the presence of mind to kind of think things through. He looked over at the movie marquee and realized that the movie they wanted to see was, you know, half or two-thirds over. So nothing was making sense. During the course of the conversation, he suddenly realizes these two children have solid black eyes. And I have to clarify that. We're not talking, as Philip said, we're not talking about a kid that's been punched. We're not talking about just the pupil. We're talking about the entire sclera. The entire eye is solid black. And seeing that was enough to shake Bethel up. He put his window up and he drove away from these two kids. When he posted this story on the internet, it really kind of compelled people who were part of that discussion group. And a few of these stories started to spread a little bit on the internet. So some other encounters surfaced. People were saying, "Wow, this is just like what I encountered," and they would tell their story. So there were a handful of these tales that were floating around the internet. And being interested in all aspects of the paranormal most of my life, I had heard the stories, I'd read them on the internet myself, but sort of filed it away in my brain for future reference. It was interesting, it was very different, it was a little compelling, but at the same time, it was right on the border where it could be urban legend, You know, it was a little, it was almost too spooky to be true just because there was something creepy about it. And it wasn't exactly like anything else. So setting it aside, several years later, early 2000s, I met a gentleman who was a complete, he didn't believe in anything paranormal. He thought it was all a joke. He didn't hesitate to make cracks when I was around, you know, in good nature, but, you know, it was always, oh, just catch any flying saucers or, you know, capture Bigfoot or all these types of things. But you learn over the years that people like that who can't leave it alone, it's often because something nags at them on a personal level. So that indeed turned out to be the case. This gentleman whose story is documented in the book, his name is Paul. He was a prison guard, and he sat down one day and just opened up to me and told me his story. And it was about an encounter with a pair of these kids. And I'm going to sidetrack for a moment and tell you the basic things from these encounters. There's a handful of common themes that we see. One is that children always have solid black eyes. Two is the skin of these children is usually described in various ways as either being pale or pasty. Some people even say it looks artificial. And what happens during the course of the encounter is that the children attempt to get you to invite them inside, whether it's inside your home, a place of business, your vehicle. They're looking for an invitation. And this harkens back to a lot of classic folklore that we'll go into if you like. But these kids, they never intrude. They never push their way in. They don't rush across the doorway. They simply continue to repeat these very specific phrases in a monotone voice, and they say them over and over again, trying to get you to invite them in. When the encounter begins, almost everyone says they're initially uneasy. That uneasy feeling rapidly goes to being very nervous, to outright fear. Some people describe it as terror. Most people actually run from these kids. They slam the door or they drive away. They just reach this point where it's fight or flight, but there's no thought of flight. It's just all, I've got to get away. And they get away from these children as quickly as they can.
And I just want to jump in here for a minute and ask you, the accounts that I read in your book, it seems like this feeling of uneasiness tends to happen well before they realize that these kids have solid black eyes. Because you could say, well, sure, you know, if a kid is looking at me and his eyes are solid black, I'm going to be uneasy too. But what I'm seeing in these accounts is often the kids are looking down or they have hoodies on. And, you know, it takes a minute before the person realizes that what's really wrong here is that these children have solid black eyes. So the uneasiness is kind of a type of intuitive knowledge that something is wrong here.
Absolutely. It seems that the encounter is almost designed to conceal those eyes initially, so that sort of gives an added punch to the growing unease that these people are experiencing. And, you know, usually as the encounter unfolds, what will happen is, yes, the children are often, they're looking down, they're looking at their shoes, or they're, you know, they have hoodies on that are pulled up and sort of concealing their faces. And at some point during that encounter, they will look up and make eye contact, or the person will, you know, attempt to look at the kids better. Paul's encounter is sort of a classical example of a lot of these cases. You know, Paul, he came home from work. It was early evening. He was home alone. And he went to the kitchen to, you know, make a sandwich or something. And he hears this knocking, you know, this long, continuous knock at the door. And like many of us would do, it gave him pause. You know, he sort of thought, is that somebody knocking on the door? All the common things go through his mind. You know, why aren't they using the doorbell? You know, is it the front door? So he goes to the front door and he opens the door. And there are two kids around 10 years old standing on his steps, heads down. And, you know, Paul's like 6'3". This guy's a prison guard, a martial artist. Huge, you know, bodybuilder, and he opens the door, and these kids say, "Hey, we just thought we'd stop in for a bit." And being an OPS guy, he kind of like, I think you guys have the wrong house. And as this encounter unfolds, you know, Paul was trying to reconcile this in his thought process, thinking, wow, these kids are too old to be friends of my child. I don't know them from the neighborhood. All the common things that someone like him would go through. And when he moves forward to try to get a better look at these kids, that's when they look up and make eye contact with him. That's when he realizes solid black eyes. And that is the escalation point of this feeling that he's having. And it causes him to, rush into the house and slam the door on them.
So what happens next? Because once he realizes that something is wrong, he closes the door, but they don't go away.
That's right. In Paul's case, he slammed the door. He said that he actually stood there with his back against the door for a moment. He strides across the room into his living room, and he's trying to process this because this is a man, I jokingly call him a John Wayne character because this is a guy who's not used to being afraid of anything. Now, all of a sudden, he's encountered something that he doesn't understand. He's completely terrified of, but it's kids. So there's a psychological aspect that he's wrestling with. He's standing in the middle of his living room trying to shake this off when he hears a sound. It's this tapping noise. He turns around and looks, and Paul's front door is framed by the little glass panels. Peering in one of those panels is the face of one of these kids. And his black eyes peering into the room at him. And whether it's because he's far enough away or he's gotten control of himself, whatever it is, something kind of snaps in Paul at that moment. And he goes instantly from fear to anger. He rushes to his bedroom. He retrieves his firearm. He rushes back out to the front door, flings it open, and there's nothing there. Mm. They just completely vanished. And he's kind of stupefied. Paul told me that in those few seconds, the only thing he could think is he wanted to go terrify these kids the way they had frightened him. But now there's nothing there. So, he goes outside. He searches the yard. He searches the street. He walks up and down the blocks. There's nothing. There's no sign of these kids anywhere. People out in the street, on the block, they haven't seen anything unusual. So these kids have just completely vanished. And this is another typical component of these encounters. There are cases where law enforcement people will see these kids. They'll turn their heads for a few seconds, turn back, and these kids have vanished.
Now, Paul comes to you and tells you this story. This person who has given you all kinds of, ribbing and abuse for being a paranormal investigator. Now he comes to you and says, okay, I've got to tell you what I saw, right? So, you know this guy isn't making it up. He's not the kind of guy to do this. So what happens to you? So you hear this story from Paul, and as a paranormal investigator and a guy who's just thoroughly fascinated by the unexplained, where does this take you next?
Oh, I was totally intrigued by it. And Paul came to me because he was hoping for answers. He was hoping for some logical explanation. He just wanted to understand, one, what he encountered, and two, he wanted to be assured that there were things he could do to not experience this again. So, at the time, I couldn't do a whole lot for him. I talked with him extensively, and, I told him, look, this is not the only encounter like this that I've heard of. Now, at the time, of course, there were only the internet stories. But I told him, I said, look, let me look into this more and let me see what I can find out for you. And so that's what I did. I started digging. And, this was, again, early 2000s. I mean, the internet was still growing. It wasn't anywhere like it is now. And it was very difficult to trace down anyone on the internet at the time who had these encounters. I did find a couple of people, but the most popular encounters, it seemed very difficult to find those people. And just through my network of being involved in the paranormal for so long, I started asking questions. And it took quite some time. The cases that are in the book, they've come to me over quite a few years. But the more I dug into this, the more intrigued I was, just because it shares things in common with so many different aspects of the paranormal. That I found that completely fascinating. You could look at these kids and the cases, and you could argue that they're some kind of demonic entity. You could argue that they are alien hybrids. You could argue there's a whole list of things. And the reason is they share so many things in common with different types of paranormal phenomena.
Well, one of the first things that struck me when I was reading the accounts and also listening to you speak in Minneapolis was this whole concept of vampire rules, right? The vampire right. rules, the vampire can't enter the house unless you invite them. Because the one thing that you see over and over again in the accounts of the encounters with these kids is that they are constantly asking to be invited in. As you said a few minutes ago, they don't push themselves in. They don't inflict themselves upon you. They merely stand there and ask you over and over again, come on, let us in. We just want to come in for a bit. Just let us in. And the other thing that really fascinated me is this concept of them constantly reassuring people, we're just kids. Hey, let us in. We're just a couple of kids. Hey, we're just kids. We want to come in. It's almost like this kind of Manchurian candidate programming that they've been given. Like they've been given these phrases, and these are the phrases that they repeat over and over again. So what do you think about this whole vampire rules thing?
Well, you know, this whole thing with the phrases, now that's a really compelling aspect too, because a lot of people say that they believe that the kids are trying to exert some type of mind control. There's a really interesting case in the book, a woman I spoke with who had actually used hypnotherapy herself to quit smoking. And she said that, you know, when she first started using it, she had a difficult time getting into a relaxed state and allowing herself to be put under. So she had to work with this therapist a few times. And she said that it was a very distinctive feeling that she developed when she was sort of slipping into that trance. And she told me that when she encountered these kids and they started talking, repeating these monotone phrases, she felt the same thing. She felt like she was starting to go into a trance. And it, you know, that in itself creeped her out. And then, of course, all the other added aspects of the black eyes and everything, you know, was enough to really frighten her. But that's an interesting component to this. And we hear this more frequently than not, you know, the monotone phrases, that the kids won't really respond to questions. They'll usually just redirect. And it's almost as if they have memorized or been programmed with a certain number of phrases that they just keep defaulting back to over and over and over again. Now, this mind control aspect, it does tie in with classical vampire lore. And, you know, some people, when you start talking about vampires, they kind of scoff at it because, oh, it's just television, yada, yada, yada. Well, you know, when you go back to folklore and mythology, there's so much rich material there that you just have to understand how it translates into our world because, you know, those stories, they came from something. So there's a very interesting aspect to these encounters that harkens back both to vampire lore and demonic lore. Because, you know, classical demonology teaches that a demon can't enter unless it gets an invitation. And that's, you know, whether it's an entrance into your home or an entrance into your body or your spirit. So the encounters with these kids, they do share things in common with both vampires and demons. And, you know, I'm not completely sure what to make of that. It to me says that there's something going on that we don't completely understand in modern terms, but I think it links back to what my personal feeling about the kids is, and that's that there's some type of interdimensional being. So, you know, this may be a metaphor. They may be looking for entrance into our world and not so much just our individual homes.
So they knock on your door. Most of the stories we've heard so far suggest that we are confronted with a world whereby there is a niece and we're not going to invite them in. But there have to be stories about people who have invited them in. as you said, these are children. We have a special leniency to invite them in. Maybe it's during a rainstorm or some kind of, you know, condition whereby middle of the night, whereby the normal rules sometimes don't apply, and they will be invited in. What happens?
Well, you know, I do want to say there is a psychological component here, as you're sort of addressing, and that's that as adults, we're really hardwired to help children if they need something. So, you know, what I find in a lot of these encounters that people are having, it almost, you know, one person told me that he felt like his brain was starting to short circuit because he was terrified to let these kids in, but at the same time, he was trying to make himself do it because they appeared to be children who needed help. So, you know, anytime you put children in the paranormal, it creates a really strange effect on people, both psychologically and emotionally. And that's something that you really have to consider when you hear these stories, is that these people are wrestling with contradicting feelings that they can't reconcile that quickly. As far as the invitations, there are a very small handful of stories that I've, you know, vetted myself and been able to verify, yeah, this is, you know, these people are being honest and this is what has happened. There's one that's documented in the book, simply because those people allowed me to publish the story. They were, it was a very compelling situation, and it was an invitation. It was not, it was an inadvertent one. What happened was there was a woman who was driving home from work. She had her 10-year-old son in the back of her SUV, sitting directly behind her. She stopped at a convenience store. She's done this, you know, a million times. She jumps out of the SUV, leaves her son in the car. She runs inside. She gets her bread and her milk. She comes back out. Like a lot of us do, she jumps in that SUV sort of on autopilot, putting the key in the ignition and turning it as she's looking up in the rearview mirror. And staring back at her in the rearview mirror is this child with solid black eyes. And this boy is in the middle of the back seat, sitting directly beside her son. She has an instant reaction of fear. She jumps out of the SUV, yanks the back door open, pulls her son out, runs back into the store. The clerk at the store, of course, you know, sees her running in a panic. He thinks there's something wrong, and she's sort of stuttering and stammering about somebody in her car. And he runs outside, thinking that, you know, who knows what, there's a carjacking or whatever going on, even though this is a quiet town. He runs outside. There's the SUV sitting. The door's open and the engine running, and there's not a sign of anyone, nothing. So he takes the keys out and carries them into her, and she's just in a real state. He wants to call the police. She doesn't want to. You know, she convinces him not to. She finally calls her husband, who's fairly close by. They live close by. And she doesn't tell him yet on the phone. She doesn't tell him what's going on, just that he needs to come up to the store and meet her. So when he gets there, they switch vehicles because she's still too shaken up to get back in the SUV. So she takes his vehicle with her son, drives home. He takes the SUV, heads for home. A couple of miles away, he's in an accident. He totals the car, ends up in the hospital. As the story unfolds, the mother has talked to her son, and she's saying, did you know that boy from school? You know, who is that? And the answer is, no, Mommy, I don't know him. And she says, well, why did he get in our car? And her son replies, well, I asked him to get in, Mommy. I thought we could go to my house to play. So.
So in this case, it doesn't look like the kid asked to come in, or maybe he did, and little boy just didn't relate the story in that way.
Yeah, he did. He basically said something like, you know, well, you'd have to ask me to come, or, you know, something to that effect that caused this. And it's a 10-year-old boy. Right. He doesn't think there's anything wrong, and all he sees is a potential playmate. So he invites the kid to get into the SUV. And a small detail here that I'm not positive is in the book, because I'm still talking to these people and little bits and pieces are coming out. So when this child got in the SUV, he actually climbed over their son to sit in the middle. So the rest of the story is the husband, you know, he's kept in the hospital for observation. Fortunately, he's okay. And, you know, the mother, of course, explains to the husband what has transpired. Now, the 10-year-old boy, their son, becomes ill. And, of course, they take him to the doctors. Problem is, the doctors can't figure out what's wrong with him, because every time they think they've diagnosed what the problem is, his symptoms change. And this is, of course, is very bizarre for everyone involved. I mean, they think at one point this child has appendicitis. You know, they think he has the flu. You know, suddenly he breaks out in a rash. They think he has the measles. It constantly shifts, and as a result, they can't treat him. They just don't know what to do. So, you know, the family ultimately ends up, you know, taking him home and essentially just focusing a lot of positive energy and prayer on this child, and he eventually recovers. But he was sick for quite some time, and fortunately, you know, he's well today. But you know, the family has definitely been changed from this experience. The parents have kind of flip-flopped back and forth between, you know, the mother for a while started turning to spiritual pursuits, and then the father did. And at this point, I talked to them fairly recently, at this point they are both very much on a spiritual path, and they both are convinced that whatever they encountered was something completely evil, and you know, in their terms, something demonic.
So in the one case that we are aware that there is contact, where the child is invited in, evil befalls the family, basically. There are accidents, there is illness. So we certainly see that it does not bode well to let these children in. I had a really interesting conversation with a woman in Minneapolis following your talk. We had a little bit of a heated debate about this because I was talking to this woman afterwards, and she approached me because we had been sitting near each other listening to your discussion. And she said, well, I just don't think I believe in these black-eyed children, because if they existed and if these encounters actually happened, then we would know what happened once you let them in. And my response to that was, no, we don't. We, you know, maybe the fact that we know nothing is precisely why these black-eyed children do exist. You know, the one thing that I was struck by over and over again is that they disappear as quickly as they appear. You know, this is the one thing in every single one of the encounters that you see, is that these kids vanish. Whether it's, you know, the prison guard, whether it's the woman in the car, a number of other situations where the kids come to the door or to the car window, all of a sudden they are gone as quickly as they arrived. And I find that really, really interesting. And that kind of goes back to your theory that they could be interdimensional. There is something that is allowing these beings to appear and to disappear. And who is to say that if you let them in, you don't go wherever it is that they disappear to? I mean, I think that the fact that we don't know what happens is really interesting. And one of the things that you and I talked about a little bit in Minneapolis is how many hundreds of people disappear in an unexplained way. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. It's, you know, the number, gosh, I had the number for a while. It's phenomenal. It's several thousand people a day, I believe is the figure, disappear. And, you know, that's really mind-boggling to think about, you know, that several thousand people a day. If you just stop and think about that figure, even when you take off, you know, even if you take half of those off and attribute it to crime, or, you know, people who are simply running away, you know, and you take another percentage off for, you know, people that are eventually recovered, you're still talking about phenomenal numbers. And even if 10% of that is something that's beyond the scope of the norm. You know, you're talking about a lot of people. And, you know, I'm certainly not saying that, you know, hundreds of people are disappearing every day because of black-eyed kids, but at the same time, it is an intriguing thing to think about, you know, and I get asked that all the time, actually, you know, well, what about all the people that disappear? And yeah, we just don't know. It actually, I'm sort of like you, Kathleen, I find it all the more compelling that there are so few stories that detail what happens when these kids are invited in, because I'm sure it's happening somewhere along the way. You know, it seems that in the cases we do have to study, or at least that I have to study, the closer the proximity of these kids, the more negative things that befall people. Mm-hmm. You know, there are cases where, there's a couple of cases where people have touched these kids or been touched by them, and the results are horrible. You know, people are finding that their relationship suddenly falls apart, or, you know, they lose their jobs, they become ill, they've had deaths in the family. You know, we're talking about extreme things. And to, you know, obviously we can speculate about it all day, but it definitely is an intriguing possibility to explain at least a tiny portion of the disappearances that we have in this country.
But of course, there is a group of people called skeptics who are able to explain this quite easily, or at least imaginatively, and you have come upon their radar, and they have enlightened you with their wisdom.
They have, with their proclamations, is what I like to say. They, you know, I always like to say right up front, I don't believe in skeptics. Nobody's proven to me that they exist. So, you know, until I have firm evidence that they're out there, I just can't accept it. However, that being said, yeah, I had a dialogue that's actually in the book. It that chapter amuses a lot of people. And it's about my dealings with a skeptic who really put a lot of time and energy into attempting to persuade me to leave this topic alone. It was that in itself I found very strange. You know, I couldn't quite understand why he was so committed to try to put me off investigating this. You know, they have a whole litany of reasons that they will, you know, give to explain these encounters. And the most common ones we hear are drug use. Well, there's no drug that turns the entire eye solid black. Just doesn't happen. The second popular one is that it's a hoax of some kind. And they attribute this to the fact that there are indeed theatrical contact lenses that you can purchase that it's called a full sclera contact. Covers the entire eye. They do make solid black ones. And, you know, I'm sure that there are a tiny percentage of these cases, usually involving adults that are black-eyed, that, you know, is a hoax. But when you start looking at the facts, I spoke to a number of theatrical companies that sell these contacts. First of all, they're somewhere in the range of $250 for a pair. And, you know, the theatrical companies that sell them, you know, I talked to these people. I said, how many of these do you sell to kids? Well, we don't really sell them to kids. Okay. you know, I pursued it a little bit more and talked to people who were actually wearing some of these various full contact lenses. And let me say, too, the most popular ones are actually what are called the zombie lenses, or the, you know, I think they call them like the cat eyes, you know, that are used to give the eye a cat-like appearance or a reptilian appearance. All of those are the most popular ones. People who wear these at costume parties and events and things like that, over half the people report that they're very uncomfortable. They limit your peripheral vision, because, you know, you think about anybody who wears contacts knows that they get uncomfortable occasionally. But if you think one that covers the entire eye, I think that would be terribly uncomfortable. I've never tried a pair on, but so a lot of people find these things very uncomfortable to wear, limits their peripheral vision. And I'm talking with a skeptic and I'm pointing all these things out and I'm saying, okay, well, you know, let's suppose that these are hoaxes. What, you know, why is this happening? And what's, you know, explain this to me. So the explanation I received was that these kids are buying these contact lenses online. I said, okay, well, you know, we're looking at $200 to $300 for a pair. You know, how are they getting them? Well, they're swiping their parents' credit cards and using them. Okay, I think I would notice that if my kid was doing that, but, you know, we'll let that one go. I said, okay, what's the next step? What are they doing then? Well, these are, you know, kids that are putting these on and they're driving to a town where no one knows them. They're running up and knocking on doors and scaring people by saying something, and then they run away. So, you know, my response was, okay, well, you know, where's the payoff? You know, why are they doing this? Well, they go back and post their experience on internet chat rooms. I thought, great, this, you know, this may end my investigation. Just give me the links to some of those chat rooms. Well, I don't have any of those. Okay, but, you know, bear in mind, this is the skeptic who, you know, claims to take a scientific approach and deal only in facts. And I said, well, you know, okay, well, you know, surely these would have turned up in all my internet searches. Well, they're hard to find. You know, okay. Well, just provide me some of the links. Well, I don't know where those links are. Okay. But you've seen these sites. Well, no, but a fellow skeptic has, and he told me about it. So it gets more and more amusing as this goes along. And, you know, the funny thing was I found this skeptic's version of how this was happening less plausible than some interdimensional being coming through and trying to, you know, swipe energy or something from some people. You know, I've raised teenagers, and organizing one to take the trash out is a complete challenge. This guy is claiming to me that there is an international network of these kids who spend their time doing this just for the thrill of posting it on the internet. And I'm sorry, anybody who has teenagers, they're going to know that these kids are more interested in the latest hip-hop music or, you know, right, teenage romance and everything else. It's absurd. It's completely absurd.
It is absurd. And I also want to mention that a lot of these kids are not teenagers. You know, one of the things that we see through the thread of this is that sometimes they're 10 and 12. You know, I have an 11-year-old boy, and he's an incredibly smart, straight-A student, you know, capable of a lot of things. But he would never be capable of putting together, you know, this grand scheme, you know, to find full sclera contact lenses and rally older friends to drive him around so he could go and scare people. I mean, he wouldn't do that anyway, but it's ridiculous to think that a 10-year-old would do such a thing.
Yeah, it's crazy. And you're right, Kathleen, the age that is the most common that I hear in these cases is 10 years old. Now, you know, you have to bear in mind that a lot of the people who have these encounters, they don't have kids of their own, so they're sort of estimating. And, you know, I often hear, well, they were between 8 and 10 years old, or they were between 10 and 12 years old. So we're still looking in that same age range. And, you know, most people aren't going to mistake a 16-year-old for a 10-year-old. So, you know, I feel pretty confident in what these people are saying. And it's, yeah, the skeptic's version is just, it's very amusing. It really is. It stretches the boundaries, that's for sure.
Well, and that's the funny thing, is that often what the skeptics try to make us believe is rational is a whole lot crazier than some of the things that we're, you know, that we're potentially looking at. Quick question, are any of these kids female?
Yes.
So yes, there are girls, because I was, you know, thinking that through most of the encounters that I read about, they were boys. There was one that I saw where there was an adult female, but the kids, the younger kids, tend to be male. Am I right?
We hear of boys more often than we do girls. Yeah, but there are some cases. There's one that really impressed me a lot because it came from a sheriff's deputy, and it was a case where this gentleman, this officer, was out on a domestic disturbance call, and I forget the exact time. It's like 2:30 or 3:30 in the morning. He goes, he deals with this situation. He doesn't arrest anyone. He's sitting in his car, you know, filling out his paperwork or whatever, and he's every few minutes looking up and around the neighborhood. And at one point he looks up and he notices that at the house next door to the one he was called to, there are two kids standing out on this deck. And he's thinking, my God, you know, what are two kids doing out this time of morning? He immediately gets out of his car and he goes up to this house. And this is a raised deck, so he walks up the steps and he finds these two kids standing on the deck, a boy and a girl, and he starts looking them over, and he's asking them questions. He's thinking, God, these kids are really pale. Their eyes are dark, you know. Now he's thinking, wow, is this, you know, is this an abuse situation? Is this what's going on here? He's asking these kids what's happening, and all they'll say is, we want to go inside. They won't let us in. So, you know, thinking that he's going to get to the bottom of this, he turns and knocks on this door, and, you know, he calls out sheriff's department, glances back around, and these kids are gone. Now, I have to clarify that and say that when he was standing at the door, he was blocking the only set of steps on this deck. The deck is raised and has a railing around it. So these kids would have to have leapt off of the deck and landed in the yard somewhere and then run away. And this, you know, was impossible. You know, he shines his light all around the yard. He looks around. There's no sign of these kids anywhere. They have just completely vanished from his sight. And when he finally gets the person roused up from in the house, it turns out to be an elderly woman, no kids of her own, no grandkids, doesn't know what this police officer is talking about, you know, at 3 a.m. So that was an impressive case to me because you find people like this that are trained observers that are caught in these situations, and you know they have a lot of the details, and at the same time, they have no explanation whatsoever for what they encountered.
Going back to some of the ancient lore, there were a couple of other things that really struck me here. One of them is the majority of these cases happen at about sunset. So there tends to be this kind of twilight area when this is occurring. That's one of the things that really struck me as I was reading the encounters. Someone had just come home from work. Someone was driving home from work. There tends to be a twilight aspect to this. So it's not that they show up in the middle of the night. And there are very few accounts, although I think there are one or two, where it's broad daylight. But I saw this aspect of showing up in the twilight period over and over again. And as a Celtic researcher, that struck me because, you know, in Celtic lore, this idea of the margin between night and day is certainly a time when the veil is thinner. So it would make sense, based on Celtic lore and tradition, that this would be a period where if a being was going to travel through a veil between the dimensions, it would happen in this twilight period. Based on what you know of these encounters and how many you have researched, does that sound accurate to you?
Oh, absolutely. And that's something I considered very heavily when I was writing the book. You know, it is significant to me that that's the time frame these beings show up. I'd say probably, I bet close to 80% of the cases that I've personally, you know, investigated, that's the time frame we're looking at. There's also a percentage that happen in the wee hours of the morning just before, you know, sunrise. So we're looking at the flip side of that in-between time. And I think that's very compelling. And to me, it sort of adds credence to the idea that there's some type of dimensional being that's coming through. And, you know, I should clarify for people, the book is written in a way that doesn't push any one particular agenda at all. I basically put all the facts out there and examine the different theories and let people decide for themselves, because people really polarize on this for some reason. It's very curious. You know, some people are adamant that they believe these are alien hybrids. Some people are adamant that they're demons. And I think everybody develops their own strong opinion about it. But, you know, I'm often asked what my personal opinion on it is. And, yeah, it reflects to back to what you're saying, Kathleen, and something that, you know, the three of us discussed some in Minneapolis, the idea that these are some type of interdimensional being coming through into our world and perhaps trying to gain a foothold.
Well, that certainly works for me. I'm not sure what they want. I mean, I think that's what, you know, I wrestle with. And, of course, I'm always trying to find the, you know, the Pollyanna moment. I'm always trying to say, okay, is there some good in this? Does this have to be all evil? You know, could they be harbingers of something? Are they bringing us an omen? Are they warning us? Are they telling us that we're, you know, damaging the earth with the way that we're living in it? You know, is there some Native American or indigenous aspect to it? That is more of a nature spirit. So I'm always trying to put some a kind of a little bit of a happier spin on it to see, you know, is this teaching us something spiritually? And I might be completely off base because it might really be just a dark, you know, manifestation. But one of the things that you did say over and over again when we were discussing this and in your presentation is that a lot of the people who have these experiences go on to have a powerful spiritual revelation as a result of this, or end up on some kind of a spiritual path, or have their lives change in a positive way because they have been so scared out of their wits by something so inexplicable. So maybe it isn't all bad in a strange way.
Well, and that's probably the only positive thing I have, you know, personally seen come out of any of these encounters. It's really interesting, you know, looking at the cases, I always look for commonalities. And for a long time, I was looking at these accounts and I was trying to find the common threads. You know, do these people, for instance, share the same religious background or racial background, or, you know, are they similar in age, or, you know, a whole broad scope of things. And very, very few commonalities amongst the, you know, the victims of these encounters. Only a couple things that did show up, and one was there's an unusual number of people who have these encounters who work in a position of authority. So police officers, military people, you know, doctors, nurses, government employees. That was one interesting common thread. And of course, the other one is one that you've pointed out, in that a large number of people who have these encounters turn to spiritual pursuits after the encounter. Now, we can look at that a couple of different ways. I suppose we could look at it in a positive way and say, okay, well, these kids are, you know, these beings are showing up and helping get people on track. I don't personally think that's the case. I think it's maybe a fortunate side effect of what's happening to some of the people who have these encounters. You know, these beings, whatever they are, they seem to have a sinister agenda to me. And as far as what they want, I believe that they're coming in to feed on energy, for lack of a better term, because it doesn't escape me that in the bulk of these encounters, these children disappear when the victim has reached that peak of fear. So, you know, if we can stretch our minds for a moment and imagine a being that actually feeds on emotional energy, then, you know, you're looking at something that comes in and creates a situation, a dynamic where an emotional peak is reached, and that's a lot of energy.
And
then
so,
these things disappear. It's
so it is a vampire of sorts, right? I mean, it's not a traditional "I want to suck your blood" kind of vampire, but it is vampirical in that it is absorbing somebody's energy. So therefore, the vampire rules element of the story isn't so far-fetched.
That's true. And this also actually crosses over into another field, and that's there's something else called a tulpa. And this is a term that's not familiar to a lot of people. Tulpa is a Tibetan term. We would equate it in the Western world more commonly with the idea of a thought form. In the Far East, in the ancient teachings of Tibet, there's a concept that a being can be created from pure mental energy. And it goes through stages of creation. This has to be done by their teachings in a very specific way that involves, you know, a series of meditations and very particular types of meditations. But what happens is the being goes from just a thought in your consciousness to a sort of wispy form like a ghost. And eventually, if you continue this process, the being makes its way into full physical form. Now, once a tulpa is fully physically realized, it can break away from its creator and continue to essentially live its own life. But it still has to have energy to survive and to thrive. And the type of energy it needs is emotional energy. So, that's sort of in the same range of this, you know, here we have yet another being from a completely different culture that feeds on energy again.
Well, I mean, you know, it doesn't sound all that far-fetched to me. It makes a lot of sense. But going back to the creepy factor, not like this all isn't creepy, but there were two things, there were two different phrases that showed up in the encounters that chilled me to the bone. And one of them was the kid who showed up at the door and asked, "Is it food time?"
Yeah. That story, yeah, that's a story out of Texas. And it involved a gentleman who is in the Dallas metro area. He was coming home from the store, walked up to his front door. He had his grocery bags in his hand. And he put his hand on the door handle and opened the door. And just as he's opening it, he realizes that there is this boy standing on the ground by his steps. And he turns and looks at this kid. And, you know, it has all the classical components. The kid has pale skin and solid black eyes. And as soon as he turns and looks at this kid, the child says to him, "Is it food time?" And I don't know about you, but I think that's one of the creepiest things I've ever heard. You know, just put in the context of that encounter. And this guy didn't even know what to say. You know, first of all, who talks like that? No one does.
Right.
You know, second of all, you know, here's a situation where he's immediately frightened and he's almost paralyzed. He said that, you know, he knew the door had opened and all he could do was sort of stare at this kid. And, you know, the phrase is repeated, something to the effect of, "I think it's food time. You should invite me in."
At which point you have to wonder, am I the food, right?
Right. Is that, you know, what's this kid want to eat? But another fascinating component about this encounter is that this is one of the few accounts where there is an animal present. This gentleman had a 3-year-old pit bull that he had raised from a puppy. Hears it barking in the back of his house. And he looks down into his house. There's a hallway that sort of leads to the front door. And he has solid wood floors in his house. He sees that pit bull round the corner at the end of the hall, charging for the front door. It gets almost to the front door, and then it pulls a Scooby-Doo. It tries to put the brakes on. And anyone who's ever seen a dog do that, you know, it's just pretty funny to watch. But, you know, this guy was just completely stunned because all of a sudden his pit bull puts the brakes on, literally falls over itself onto the steps, jumps up, tail between his legs, heads down, running back into the house, whining. And the dog ended up going in and hiding under the master, the bedroom in the master bed. And, you know, this gentleman was just, now he was really shaken up. And that was sort of the push that he needed, I think, to sort of, you know, jump in the door and slam the door shut and go see where his dog was, only to find it hiding under the bed. He's never been able to reconcile this. You know, he said that he has seen this dog kill rattlesnakes with his teeth. And here all of a sudden it's terrified of some kid standing on the, you know, on by the steps. So he even told me recently, he said, this dog has never been the same since then. And of course, as with most of these stories, you know, the gentleman went around to one of his other windows, looked out the, you know, through the blinds, and the kid had vanished. You know, it was just gone. And now he's, you know, no sign of him anywhere. But something affected this dog at a really deep level. And of course, we all know that, you know, animals have a different level of sensitivity than we do. So we have to wonder what exactly was it that that dog sensed that terrified him so.
Absolutely. Well, that story and many others can be found in David Weatherly's fantastic book, The Black-Eyed Children. I'm telling you, I am so completely obsessed with these stories. I'm fascinated by them. The book is compellingly readable. It is so much fun to read and so fascinating. And as David says, he doesn't push any particular theory about what the children are or what they want, but rather he reports his investigations into these stories and these accounts. It's a fascinating book. If you are interested in the paranormal in any way, shape, or form, you will not be able to put this book down. David Weatherly, The Black-Eyed Children. You can get this from his publisher, Leprechaun Press, and that's Leprechaun. And David's website is
twocrowsparanormal.blogspot.com.
twocrowsparanormal.blogspot.com. David Weatherly, thank you so much for being our guest on the Spirit Revolution. One of the things that the Black Eyed Kids always say, the other thing that really creeps me out, is they say, this won't take long. This won't take long, which always makes me wonder exactly what it is that won't take long. But unfortunately, this has not taken long, because talking to you is something that goes by so fast. We've gone through our hour. I could talk to you for many hours more, and I hope you'll come back and talk to us again, because you have a lot of other things coming up. You've got a new book coming out in the near future as well, right?
That's correct. It'll be out hopefully by the end of the year. It's called Strange Intruders.
Well, with Halloween coming up and that doorbell going to be ringing and people knocking on your doors and small children knocking on your doors, remember, if they ask to be let in and specifically ask for food time,
don't let them in.
If, however, it's just a bit of candy, by all means, give it to them. If you want to listen to this one again, unless you did let in the wrong people, there is several ways of doing that. You can go to iTunes, search for The Spirit Revolution, and you can find this as well as several other of our broadcasts, completely free, completely downloadable from iTunes. You can go to our website, thespiritrevolution.com. You can listen there to several of our episodes again, as well as see a complete survey of all the episodes we've ever done. If you want to listen to some very old of our podcasts, you have to head over to the bbsradio.com archives on, obviously, bbsradio.com. For a small fee there, you will get access to not just our shows, but also loads of other shows and presenters who have been collecting the stories of so many. This has been a Halloween edition of The Spirit Revolution. We will be back, maybe, depending on who's knocking on our door. But when we are back, as usual, this motto will be...
the truth against the world.
Be careful when you open that door.